Hello. Today is Tuesday, April 30th, 2024, last day of April. Welcome to the Twin Ports News recorded by volunteers at the Lighthouse Center for Vital Living in Duluth for the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. I am Tracy Goman, and my reading partner today is Nancy Aitzen. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
We will be reading primarily local articles from the Duluth News Tribune and the Superior newspaper. We are the only service in this area that also reads obituaries. Today, we have one obituary and one death notice. We will read those today after the opinion page. The top headlines in the Duluth News Tribune today are: Board meeting. Surfers ride Lake Superior's frigid waves. And CSS to stop producing theater. Now, with our first story, here's Nancy.
Thank you. College of St. Scholastica to stop producing theater. Students assembled Monday to protest decision to cease college-run theatrical productions. This is by Jay Gabler. As of this fall, the College of St. Scholastica will no longer offer theater productions as part of its educational programming. The college cited, quote, the challenging environment of higher education, end quote, in a Friday statement announcing the change. Barbara McDonald, the college's president, told the News Tribune on Monday that, quote, theater isn't alone in our decision-making. It's been a difficult time since the pandemic, end quote. The college's vice president for academic affairs, Ryan Sandifer, acknowledged that the college's theater offerings have been shrinking in recent years with the elimination of a theater minor degree option and the cutting of the annual production slate from 4 to 2 shows. Mary Wren Vaughan, the theater program director, retired to emeritus status in 2023. Sandiford described the decision to eliminate college-run productions as, quote, very difficult but necessary, given the realities of higher education and the finances that we're seeing, end quote. By late Monday morning, about 2 dozen people had gathered outside senior administrative offices in Tower Hall, rallied by students concerned at Friday's news. A student-organized GoFundMe campaign aiming to, quote, save our voices, end quote, by advocating for the theater's programs preservation attracted over $1,000 in donations by late afternoon. Quote, I am honestly outraged, said senior Audrey Eckloff. We were given no warning, even though we've known for 3 years that the theater program was dwindling down, and we had no opportunity to help or do anything about it. It was just gut-wrenching, said senior Ella Goett. The theater program has been the place where I felt most at home on campus, more so than any other group I've ever been a part of. So the fact that it was going to be torn away from me so suddenly and without any explanation was heartbreaking, end quote. Senior Paige Staub said that while the economic challenges is understandable, quote, nationwide fine arts programs are struggling. The circumstance doesn't really negate the feelings of upset or of outrage that such a vital part of our community here at Scholastica is being cut, end quote. Outside the offices, a music stand held a petition, quote, in support of the continuation of the theater program at the College of St. Scholastica, and a sign-up sheet for students to share your feelings with Ryan Sandifer and President McDonald. Quote, continuing, we're moving. Well, that's the end of that quote. And then the next quote, we're here to listen, and we want to hear their ideas and move forward, McDonald told the News Tribune about the gathering of students. Quote, continuing, Now this is stop again. Sorry. Our program is already been cut. The budget has already been repurposed, said Staub, after talking with McDonald and Sandifer. What we could do is something like a student-led theater program for the next year or two while we talk about repurposing or finding more budgetary resources or outside grants that we can use for the program. If we were to partner up with other schools or communities or programs, said Junior Henry Mattson, I feel like we would lose a part of our history because the theater program has been here since forever, and to lose that would be like losing a legacy, end quote. McDonald said there are no current plans to make structural changes to the College of St. Scholastica Theater, popularly known as the Little Theater. Quote, not only do we have the University of Minnesota Duluth as a strong potential partner, but also the Duluth Playhouse and other entities in town that might be willing to have a conversation with us, said McDonald. We have a beautiful space. It's a very historic building, end quote. The Campus Theater, a building formerly used as a chapel and a gym, became home to regular stage productions with the founding of the Daisy Hill Theater on campus in 1977. That family-oriented theater project was led by St. Scholastica's faculty member Robert Jansen, whose career at the college would end in 1983. Quote, in a complex legal action over denial of tenure that concluded with a monetary settlement based on the perception that Jansen was fired because he was gay, end quote. According to the biography explaining the significance of his papers housed at UMD using the settlement money, Jansen went on to found the main club in Superior, then Twin Port's first openly gay bar. Campus theater advocates rallied in 1997 when St. Scholastica then-president Daniel Pylon floated the idea of converting the theater back to a gym or even into a Friends-era coffee house. The theater program was ultimately preserved, but at the prospect of reductions to St. Scholastica program, then UMD theater head Patricia Dennis told the News Tribune, quote, I can understand the reasons why budgetary decisions have to be made, but I think this will be devastating to that institution, end quote. Several UMD students went to Scholastica to join the protest action Monday. Quote, it's finals week at UMD, and we have professors that are canceling finals today so that we can come here and stand in solidarity with our fellow theater peers, said UMD student John Tovin. While UMD's theater programs are far more extensive than the short season of campus shows being eliminated at St. Scholastica, Tovin said that, quote, as arts people in general, but especially as theater people, we understand the fear of what if one day they just decide to cut our funding, because that happens all the time, everywhere in this country, end quote. And then UMD student Lisa Scott says, theater is a really important part of community and expression and makes the world a better place. It's really tragic that we are going to be missing the CSS theater, end quote. Sharon Obst, the St. Scholastica Theater Program's final director, said that even if the theater building physically remains, student use of the space may still be more challenging without a college-sponsored theater program. I don't know what sort of access they'll have to the space or what sort of hoops they'll have to jump through. Obst will remain at St. Scholastica, covering other educational responsibilities. According to Sandifer, the elimination of theater productions will reduce the college's expenses by the equivalent of two full-time staff salaries. Quote, as well as significant operating dollars and the dollars associated with student and other stipend positions. Sandifer continuing, emphasizing that, quote, the pandemic led to us having multiple years of low enrollments. We're very hopeful about where we're going from an enrollment perspective, not revenue perspective, and then how we can reinvest in opportunities to continue to drive our mission forward. End quote. And McDonald says, we have a deep commitment to the liberal arts and the fine arts, and that won't go away. She pointed out many challenges the college has faced and changes since its 19th century origins as a Benedictine academy. Our student body continues, this is Santa for now, our student body continues to amaze me each and every day, including today, said Santifer. Meeting with students, I'm blown away by their poise, their integrity, their creativity, and their passion for education and for life, end quote. Obst said she was concerned for the students who feel, quote, bereft, adrift. Theater was a space where they could feel seen and heard and have that sense of belonging, and it was very inclusive. Students of all abilities were welcomed, end quote. Goetti, one of the St. Scholastica students, quote, what we're fighting for today is obviously the continuation of the theater program. Barring that, what I'm hoping for now is that we can either get a student-led theater program running with professors as advisors, or if we can just have one more year to show what the theater program means to the community, show that it is a worthwhile use of the budget and that it is not something that should be cut, end quote. Obst says there are a lot of unanswered questions regarding the potential logistical and financial challenges of students mounting their own productions without funding staff support. Although, looking around the bustling hallway, you see how well they organize. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a tough one.
This article also has several pictures, Nancy.
Oh, yes. Do you want to do them?
Sure. The first one is of Paige Staub, a senior at the College of St. Scholastica, as she talks about organizing a sit-in on campus Monday morning after CSS announced it's eliminating its theater program. Obst is pictured as a young woman with glasses, gorgeous young skin.
Yeah.
Her hair is up in a bun. She has on a CSS t-shirt and a sweater, and she's gesturing with her hands to other students who are also in the hall with her. She has quite a, I can't really describe her expression. She is animatedly talking about something. And then the next picture, oh, for heaven's sake, I'm trying to find the next picture. Oh, my goodness. Here we go. Next image. Ah, yes. The next picture is of Ryan Sandifer, who is sitting on the left. He is the College of St. Scholastica Vice President for Academic Affairs. And on the right, we have a picture of President Barbara McDonald as they talk Monday about closing the theater program. Ryan Sandifer, who is sitting on the left of this picture, they are sitting at a desk in an office, books behind them, looks very academic. He has on a sport coat, a casual shirt. He has a beard, salt and pepper hair, glasses, gesturing also with his hands as he is talking to a person across the table, must be the reporter. And then next to him is sitting President Barbara McDonald, looking very intently at him. She has medium-length blonde hair. She is wearing a very professional-looking jacket. Her glasses are on the table in front of her. They're obviously having quite a serious conversation. The next image, oh, dear, there it is. Oh, beautiful building.
Oh, that building.
Yes. This is a picture of the College of St. Scholastica Theater. It's closed, but fog is rolling in behind it. This picture was taken on Monday. If you've never seen this building, it is an old structure. It looks like it's probably one of the original structures on campus. It looks vaguely German in that its base, up to the first level, is built with large rock, large gray rock, which continues around the building and into a very tall chimney in the background. It has this Bavarian look to it because the other facade, the next two floors, are stucco with the typical brown woodwork setting it off, except over the door where there is an arched window with many panes. Looks just beautiful. Over the doors, there is a sign that says CSS Theater. This is an old, beautiful building on campus, and you can see why these students would miss having that as a home base. The next image is of students in the hall starting their protest. One student on the right is taking pictures. So far, it's really only a clutch of students. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 students who are beginning to get organized for their protest against St. Scholastica closing the theater program. Interesting article. We're going to go back to the front page of the Duluth News Tribune, where we have some beautiful photos taken by Wyatt Buckner. This was taken Monday, yesterday. If you recall, in Duluth, there was a roaring wind, and this caused huge waves on Lake Superior. So there we have a surfer. The lake is shown with actually not huge waves, but as they come into shore, the waves are breaking and getting taller. In the background at the horizon, the lake looks almost blue-gray. But as we get closer to the shore and to the front of the picture, the lake water is turning brown because, of course, it's all roiled up and it's getting lots of rain runoff from the streams that feed into Lake Superior from the rainfall. And the surfer is standing on a red board. He is riding the wave into the shore. I should say they. I cannot tell if this is a man or a woman or who. So they are riding in a black suit covered from head to toe except for the face, also black gloves, standing there with knees bent, arms forward, probably very much enjoying that ride into shore on the red surfboard. And then there is another picture showing the waves breaking over the rocks near the shore at Gitchigami Park in Duluth. As they break, the spray is going up into the air. And in the foreground of the picture, we have that same surfer walking with the board. I can't tell whether they are going out to ride another wave. It's possible. And to the right, we have Lake Superior water as it crashes over those waves again with the spray going way up in the air. And in the foreground, the boulders are very, very dark. The water is brown. But it does appear that the sky might be clearing behind it. So I'm hoping that the lake has settled down already today. So next we have a story from the Superior Telegram written by Maria Lockwood. This story also appears in the Superior Telegram today. The story is entitled Schools, Providers, Connecting to Support Families as Juvenile Diabetes cases increase. So the picture is headed by an article of the School District of Superior Administrative Offices at 3025 Tower Avenue. It's shown on Wednesday, April 3, so there's a little bit of snow in the foreground on the grass near the parking lot. This is a low building. It looks like it's probably only one story. Doors are brown, and over the doors there is a roof with that School District of Superior wording on it. The building near the doors is brown, but to the right the right and left sides of the building are a yellowish brown brick. And there we have the flag of the United States of America waving in front of it. Here is Maria Lockwood's story. School nurses in the Superior School District took part in a type 1 diabetes troubleshooting session April 11 with Dr. Kanan Kasturi, that's spelled K-A-S-T-U-R-I, a pediatric endocrinologist with Essentia Duluth. Although Essentia offers annual educational sessions for the region's school nurses on the topic, this marked the first time Kasturi went directly to them. Quote, "We just think it's great that they're willing to do that, because taking the time out of their busy schedule to meet school districts at their place instead of requesting people to go to trainings that are outside of work time, outside of pay, sometimes that's a challenge to do," end quote, said Jennifer Marsh, a school nurse at Superior Middle School. It offered a chance to focus on individual students and their immediate issues. Quote, "This is probably one of the few times they're seeing us in person, so it gives them a face to put to a picture on those signed diabetes school plans. They know who was doing that, and it gives them a fantastic opportunity to deal with a single patient," end quote, Kasturi said. "It is a complicated disease." Quote, "With type 1 diabetes, children have to take an insulin shot, whether it be through an injection or through an insulin pump, every single time they put food in their mouth. So every time they eat, they have to calculate the amount of carbohydrates in that food," end quote, Kasturi said, "and calculate an insulin dose." Quote, "Everything in your life affects your blood sugar. From food choices to sleep to stress, illness, everything affects your blood sugars," end quote, Marsh said. School nurses serve as the bridge between student families and their health providers. Quote, "Diabetic management is very complex, but we are happy to have people being the eyes in the office here, really for the parents and kind of in between the parents and the provider's office, to help manage their diabetes best and most appropriately," end quote, Marsh said. Kasturi said he plans to travel to several local school districts to speak with nurses. It helps both sides. Quote, "They get a lot of benefits from this. We get a lot of benefits from this. We learn how to include ourselves. We learn from feedback," end quote, the pediatric endocrinologist said. The Superior School nurses, for instance, asked if they could automatically receive updated treatment plans from the healthcare provider. Marsh said both the regional and individual school sessions were helpful. Quote, "Knowledge is power," end quote, she said. Cases on the rise. Type 1 diabetes is a chronic autoimmune disease that focuses on children. The most common age of diagnosis is between 8 and 13, Kasturi said, although it can affect children as young as 2. It comprises 5 to 10% of all diabetes cases, but it is on the rise. A September study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that rates of new-onset type 2 diabetes climbed 62% And type 1 diabetes increased 17% nationwide in youth under age 20 after the COVID-19 pandemic began. The disease is typically triggered by the body's response to viral infection, Kasturi said. It takes 3 to 4 years between the time the immune response starts to complete destruction of the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. The country is currently at the three to four year mark from the peak of COVID-19 cases. Quote, and now we are noticing a lot of increase in the number of cases, end quote, Kasturi said. Marsh started working at Superior Middle School 3.5 years ago. She has seen that increase firsthand. Quote, we have 4 type 1 diabetics here, and 3 of the 4 have been newly diagnosed since they entered the middle school. So I would say 3 out of the 4 that we have been diagnosed within the 3 years that I started here, end quote, she said. The disease has a special connection to the Northland region. Scandinavian countries like Norway and Sweden have the highest incidence of diabetes. Quote, our area having such a close connection with those genes puts us at relatively higher risk than the rest of the country, end quote, Kasturi said. An upcoming walk to raise money for type 1 diabetes research, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation Community 1 Walk, will take place May 18 at Mahlowski Stadium at the University of Minnesota Duluth campus. Doors open at 9 a.m. and the 5K walk begins at 10 a.m. A shorter 1-mile walk is also available. There will be music, games, snacks, a photo station, and other activities. This is the 3rd annual event in Duluth. One of the biggest benefits it brings to the community is awareness, Kasturi said. This year, participants can learn about TrialNet, which offers a free test that screens for antibodies in the blood associated with prediabetes. Siblings and other close relatives of people with type 1 diabetes are encouraged to get the screening, which could help them detect the disease in time to slow it down. A new drug has been approved by the FDA that slows the progression into full-blown type 1 diabetes for up to 3 years, Kasturi said. Quote, if they are positive, then we can offer them this treatment. And for a kid who is 5 to 8 years, is a huge difference between maturity and other things. So that makes a big impact, end quote, Kasturi said. The screening, which involves a small blood draw, will be available at the walk. Visit trialnet.org. That's trialnet.org for more information, to set up a local blood draw, or to receive a home finger stick test kit. Wow, interesting yes. article. I learned a lot. Who knew? Whew, okay, where are we now, Nancy?
We're just going to move on to shipping traffic and bygones.
All righty.
The shipping traffic is accompanied by a photograph taken by Dan Williamson. It's the John G. Munson coming into the Duluth entry on May 11th of 23 with the lighthouse, the Park Point side lighthouse in the background on the right. And what's expected today is at the Duluth entry, 4 a.m., it must be in already, Paul R. Jugurtha arriving to load coal. And 9 a.m., he's probably in too, John G. Munson arriving to unload limestone. And for updated information, 24 hours a day, call the Boat Watchers hotline at 218-722-7000. 6489 or visit harborlookout.com. And the source of that is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the Maritime Visitor Center. And, well, trying to get to bygones now.
It'll be there somewhere.
Okay. News Tribune, April 30th of 1924, Tabby, a cat living in the Duluth jail, who is believed to have been able to predict the next day's weather by her mood, has disappeared from the jail. Jailer Lewis Johnson says he believes she eloped. And then we have April 30th of 1954. As long as auto manufacturers emphasize high power in new cars, speed will be a contributing factor in auto crashes. A panel of WDSM-TV that included a local police officer, a judge, a highway engineer, and a teenager, moderated by the News Tribune's managing editor. And then we have News Tribune and Herald, April 30th of 1984. Construction begins today on a $4.8 million project to pave Duluth's first street and its sidewalks with bricks. About $3.9 million in additional federal funds that otherwise would have paid for extending I-35 between 26th and 68th Avenues East will pay for most of the project. There's that brick project, huh? And News Tribune, April 30th, 2004, attorneys from the ACLU and the City of Duluth have reached an agreement to resolve a lawsuit regarding the Ten Commandments monument outside City Hall. Counselors are expected to vote on the agreement May 10th, and if it passes, the monument will be promptly removed. Bygones is compiled by Barrett Chase, a digital editor at the News Tribune.
Thank you, Nancy. We're turning the page already, and here we are on the opinion page of today's Duluth News Tribune. There are two opinions. Both of them concern health care coverage, the public health care coverage in Minnesota. The first of the opinions is entitled, Minnesota Should Reject a Public Option in Health Care. A personal view is a better approach, and this is the statewide view. This is written by Jake Coleman. Jake Coleman is from Waconia, Minnesota. He is the state director for the nonprofit Americans for Prosperity, Minnesota. Here are the words of Jake Coleman. After last year's legislative spending spree, Minnesota lawmakers are chomping at the bit to take more of your hard-earned money, this time by creating a health care, in quotes, public option. The name sounds appealing. Who could object to everybody having another health care choice? But the reality is problematic. Higher costs, greater government control, and unfair competition. It is an expensive short-term fix with long-term negative consequences. Minnesotans deserve a better way that creates real choice and lower prices by putting individuals, not the government, in control of their care. The public option bill on the table would expand Minnesota Care, our existing government offering for the working poor, allowing everybody to enroll regardless of their income. Supporters say this scheme would force private insurers to compete and lower their costs. The problem is, it's hard to compete against government subsidies. It's like starting a running race with your competitor already halfway to the finish line. To be sure, health insurers need stiff competition. But that competition should be fair and should lead to better outcomes for everyone. The public option would not. Instead, it would require Minnesotans to pay even more in taxes. A study published earlier this year found that the public option would cost the state between $86 million and $364 million. Lawmakers who support the bill say they don't know where that money would come from. But we know, don't we? It would come from you and me in the form of higher taxes. Would the cost be worth it? If the goal is for everybody to be insured, the answer is no. Minnesota has one of the lowest uninsured rates in the nation at 3.8%. That's less than half the national average. The study estimates only 12% of uninsured Minnesotans would enroll in the public option, leaving the number of uninsured practically unchanged. Everybody else who opts for the government plan would simply shift from their current private coverage to take advantage of taxpayer-subsidized premiums. Some people might benefit, but at a high cost to all of us. Simply shuffling pieces around the board is not the change that Minnesotans need. The government plan would reimburse doctors and hospitals at Medicare rates, which are only about half of what private insurers pay on average. That differential would make doctors reluctant to accept public option patients and thus make it harder for those patients to access the quality care they need. The current system isn't perfect. It's plagued by high prices, low transparency, and weak competition due to misguided government policies. Minnesotans don't want more government control over their health care, and they don't want a complete overhaul of the system. They want to keep what works and fix what's broken. One reason costs are so high is the large amount of money flowing to health insurance companies and other special interests with little cost control. A public option would double down on this failed approach by funneling more of your tax dollars to these same third parties. There's a better way. A personal option is a doctor-supported plan that puts you and your family in charge of your health care dollars. It arms you with direct subsidies and tax-free health savings accounts, enabling you to choose coverage that truly meets your needs and gain access to services and doctors your health plan doesn't cover. What you don't spend can be saved for future medical expenses, and this plan would retain strong government safety nets for the vulnerable. Under a personal option, patients would shop for value and providers would compete for their business based on price and quality. We see lower prices and far more price transparency. If you like what you have, you can keep it. But if you want more and better health care, you can have that too. From low-cost, subscription-based primary care to affordable, short-term renewable plans, you can pick what works best. It's like Amazon for health care. Americans prefer a personal option over the public option because it delivers what government mandates and bureaucracy can't: hassle-free, affordable health care. Health care today is too expensive, complex, and frustrating, but it doesn't have to be. Let's say no to the public option and say yes to a personal option for all Minnesotans. Again, these were the words of Jake Coleman of Waconia, Minnesota, who is director for the nonprofit Americans for Prosperity, Minnesota. This particular opinion has an accompanying cartoon drawn by R.J. Matheson of Kegel Cartoons in the style of Schultz, who is the creator of the Peanuts comic strip. So this particular cartoon in the style of Schultz has, instead of Charlie Brown in his yellow shirt with that striped logo, little short Charlie Brown with his white tennies standing once again on the pitcher's mound. Except the pitcher's mound is entitled Public Option, and Charlie Brown is pictured as a little fat donkey. And we all know that the donkey represents the Democratic point of view, the Democrats' point of view. So this donkey, who is drawn just like Charlie Brown, with the little red baseball hat standing on the pitcher's mound of public opinion, is looking up into the sky because once again it's pouring down rain. Okay, on to you, Nancy. What's the next opinion?
We have a statewide view. Now I got, I'm not getting, there it is. Biden's title insurance waiver is a threat to Minnesotans. This is a statewide view by Richard H. Welshens, and he is a manager for DCA Title and the title team in Hastings, Minnesota. He's also president-elect of the American Land Title Association Board of Directors. During his State of the Union, President Joe Biden announced an array of proposals aimed at making home ownership more accessible for those who have struggled to enter the housing market. While his administration's efforts to expand home ownership are admirable, one program in particular, which would waive title insurance requirements on refinancing transactions for certain borrowers, would be disastrous for Minnesota homeowners and the broader housing finance system. This pilot program would resurrect a proposal by Fannie Mae that was abandoned last August after bipartisan backlash from members of Congress who voiced concerns over how the program would expose lenders and taxpayers to greater risk. Instead of being insured by their local title insurance company, Fannie Mae, which is under federal government control for its role in the 2008 financial crisis, would essentially become a title insurance company, displacing the expertise and jobs of small title companies in every county in the state. Importantly, this pilot program only applies to higher wealth homeowners who are refinancing and who need federal government assistance the least. Why would the Biden administration promote such a program, especially when it would hurt the small businesses that make up 90% of the title insurance industry? Title professionals work to provide homeowners and lenders with long-term protection of their property rights. For a one-time fee, title professionals both identify and resolve title issues at the onset of a home purchase, as well as protect homeowners against losses from title defects. While homeowners only have to pay for an owner's policy once, a new lender's title insurance policy is required if a homeowner chooses to refinance, because title problems could have arisen between the old and new loan, such as having to pay past debt through thought to have been paid off. Lenders need assurance that their financial interest is protected, and that is why lenders' title insurance exists. Title insurance is a comprehensively regulated product in Minnesota, but under this pilot, Fannie Mae would be responsible for resolving title issues that arise, something that is far beyond its mission and expertise. The risks from this shift could expose the housing market to more instability, similar to the loosening of standards that preceded the 2008 financial crisis fueled by the overreach of Fannie Mae. This proposal is deeply concerning, not just for the risks it presents to the housing market, but also for the implications for Minnesota's small businesses and broader economy. According to a study released in January, the title industry directly fuels 2,800 jobs and $563 million to Minnesota's gross domestic product annually. Members of Congress from both sides of the aisle share these concerns and have introduced the bipartisan Protecting America's Property Rights Act, which would require title insurance on all loans purchased by government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs. I urge Minnesota U.S. Senator Tina Smith to help pass this bill, as well as call on the Biden administration to rethink this misguided title insurance waiver pilot program. To be clear, making homeownership more attainable for all Americans is a worthy goal and should be a key priority for the Biden administration. However, the best way to do that is by addressing the true barriers to homeownership, especially burdensome regulations and a lack of housing supply. While saving homeowners a few hundred bucks is a good talking point, the reality is that this pilot program is too risky for Minnesota and too risky for the country. Let's prioritize protecting one of the biggest purchases of a person's life, their home. Cutting corners could be costly. Hmm. There you have that. Oh, and this also has a cartoon. And here we have a doghouse that says Fido and two dogs sitting in front of it, two big, they look like Great Danes sort of dogs, maybe. I never dreamt in a million years that I would one day own a house worth over $1 million, but here it is. And then there's a for sale sign next to it, and then a sold sign above that. So there we are.
Yep. That's not so funny. Some of the the home prices. Yes.
Yeah.
And then also on this opinion page, we have one little tiny reader's view entitled, Tell Stauber He Erred on Ukraine Aid. This was written by Nancy McFarland Diener of Lakewood Township. On April 20, Representative Pete Stauber voted against aid to Ukraine. And her source is Stauber votes against Ukraine aid, backs Israel and Taiwan, from April 22. In a press release the same day, Stauber claimed, quote, "The overwhelming majority of my constituents have expressed opposition to additional funding for Ukraine," end quote. Many recent polls, though, including by CBS and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, have clearly indicated that a majority of Americans favor additional funding and aid to Ukraine. Stauber apparently thinks Minnesota's 8th Congressional District is in complete opposition to the rest of the American people. I don't. I think he only talks to and hears from his MAGA crowd. Why not show him he has this one wrong? Contact him to let him know that, one, you are his constituent, and two, you favor aid to Ukraine. His Washington, D.C. office can be mailed at 145 Cannon HOB, Washington, D.C., 20515. His phone number there is 202-225-6211, and a good email address is stauberpress@mail.house.gov. Perhaps he might have to revise his understanding of, quote, overwhelming majority. Again, those were the words of a Duluthian, Nancy McFarland Diener. So that's it for the opinion page, and I promised that we would get to an obituary this morning, and which will now open up for me. There it is. So this obituary is for Marion Carolyn Dirks. Marion Carolyn Johnson Dirks, age 90, passed away peacefully in the early morning hours on Monday, November 13, 2023. She was living at Beehive Homes in Lakeville. Marion was born to Rudy and Elsie Johnson in Minneapolis on May 3, 1933, and was the second of three children. While attending college, she met her eventual husband, Bill Dirks, from Olivia, Minnesota. They were married in 1959 and remained married until Bill's death in 2019. Marion was a music enthusiast, playing the piano and singing whenever she could. She also enjoyed family reunions and camping trips. She was a faithful and active member of First Presbyterian Church in Duluth for over 45 years. Marion is preceded in death by her parents, her husband Bill, and her brother Marshall. She is survived by her sister Carol and sister-in-law Nancy, her three children, son Michael, wife Linda Dirks, daughter Rhonda, husband Jonathan Tro, son Philip, wife Melissa Dirks, and many nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. A memorial service is being held on Saturday, May 4, at 12 o'clock noon at Lakeview Covenant Church in Duluth, Minnesota, 1001 Jean Duluth Road. The live stream link is https://lakeviewcovenant.online.church. I'll read that again. https://lakeviewcovenant.online.church. There is also a death notice for Martin Larson, November 5, 1948 to April 18, 2024. Martin Larson, age 75, Meadowlands, Minnesota, died Thursday, April 18, in St. Luke's Hospital from cancer. A celebration of life will be 3 p.m. Sunday, May 5, at Trailside Lounge in Meadowlands, Minnesota. And that is the end of our reading of an obituary. Oh, my goodness, this page. Nancy. Okay. My page will not do what I want it to do. That is the end of our reading of the obituary and death notice for today. What's next, Nancy?
Well, I have a favorite is Donald Kensler, mm-hmm. North Dakota State University Extension from Cass County. And he says, fielding questions, it says, and with mild winter, when should I seed my lawn?
Good question.
Question. The Northern Acclaim thornless honey locust in the photo, there's a photo, planted 5 years ago. What could cause the damage on the trunk? It couldn't be rabbits because the damage is higher up the trunk and there wasn't any snow for them to crawl up on. I planted two trees at the same time and the other one is not damaged. What do you think? Do you think the tree will live? That's a question from Jerry L. And yes, we have a photo of, it looks like it's about 4-inch diameter tree, and it's in a ring with the black plastic molding around the perimeter and filled with wood chips, it looks like. Mm-hmm. And you can see the bark clearly peeled off midway up the trunk. So what does he have to say? The answer. The damage in the photo is compatible with injury caused when a buck deer rubs his antlers on the tree trunk. Mm-hmm. Besides the larger area where bark has been rubbed away, Notice the slender cuts in the bark above, where tips of horns scratched narrow lines. There's really nothing that can be done to assist the tree other than wait and see. Pruning paints and sealers have long been shown to cause more harm than good. Any healing or compartmentalizing of the wound needs to come from the tree itself. To aid healing, trim any ragged wood edges smooth with a sharp knife. Will the tree survive? If only one-third of the tree's bark around the tree's circumference is scraped off, the tree will usually survive, although not always. If one-half of the tree's circumference bark is shaved off, the situation becomes more serious. If three-fourths of the bark is gone, survival is difficult. The cambrium, the tree's vital area of cell growth, is located just below the outer bark. And when the tannish white wood of the tree's interior is exposed by injury, the cambium is usually destroyed in that area. You'll know in May through June whether there's permanent damage. The tree might leaf out normally, but if it can't sustain the growth because of damaged trunk tissue, leaves would wilt and wither after June, since damaged trunk tissue can no longer pump water and nutrients up and down within the tree to maintain leaf health and life. To prevent further damage now and in future years, wrap the trunks with chicken wire or hardware cloth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know about the deer. It's very sad.
Question. With small yards in town, what bush would you plant for edible fruit? Would you recommend chokecherry? How about Iroquois Beauty chokecherry? Chokeberry? Twyla N. asks. And the answer. Chokeberry is perhaps better called by its botanical name, Aronia, because the common name chokeberry is so similar to chokecherry, and they are two totally different fruits. Chokecherry becomes a small tree or tree-like shrub growing 12 to 15 feet high and wide. Chokeberry is a much smaller shrub growing to about 5 feet high and 4 feet wide. Because of its neatly tailored height and width, Aronia makes a fine landscape shrub for small landscapes. The berries it produces contain one of the highest levels of antioxidants of any fruit. Unlike chokecherries, which are ravaged by birds, Aronia are not their preference. Aronia berries make incredible jelly, jam, juice, and wine. They can be used in baking as a substitute for blueberries. As a side note, Aronia is North Dakota's top commercially produced fruit. Huh. Besides being a prolific fruit producer, Aronia's fall color is a brilliant scarlet orange.
Well, let's have one.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. sounds like the thing to do. Mm-hmm. Should I be spreading grass seed yet on areas I need to fill in? Asks Shane B. Answer. The most common turf grass species for northern lawns is Kentucky bluegrass, and its seed doesn't germinate until soil temperatures in the 2 to 4 inch depth warm to between 50 and 55 degrees Fahrenheit. Soil temperatures in North Dakota and Minnesota are slowly rising, but they haven't achieved that important threshold yet in much of the area. If grass seed is spread too early, birds have a wide window of opportunity to feast on the seed. And if the flock is large, the seed can be totally consumed before it has a chance to sprout. Grass seed is planted very shallowly, with most of the seed being visible on the surface, making easy pickings for birds. May 1st is the average recommendation for planting grass seed in spring, and that target date is quite accurate again this year, even with the mild winter.
That's tomorrow.
Yes. So, time to get going. Mm-hmm. So, if you have any gardening or lawn care questions, we email Don Kinsler, at donald.kinzler, K-I-N-Z-L-E-R, at ndsu.edu. Questions with broad appeal may be published, so please include your name, city, and state for appropriate advice.
Ah, yes.
Very good.
I just love his articles.
Yes.
Well, next, believe it or not, we are on the, you know, near the end of our reading of the Duluth News Tribune. We are reading, I'll be reading the weather. And that's it. We have no local sports today, and no more local news in this particular edition. So I will read the weather for today, and then we'll move along to the Superior Telegram. So on the weather page today, we have our familiar boxes, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And in these boxes where we would hope to see bright sunshine every day, we don't have any of those. Tuesday and Wednesday will both be partly cloudy, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday are, you know, they're all cloudy. And almost every day, except for today and tomorrow, there's a chance of rain. So today, Tuesday, the 30th day of April, we are hoping for a high of 54, a low of 41 with morning clouds and hopefully afternoon sun. The wind will be from the west at 9 miles per hour, so hopefully that will truly allow some warmth to come to us. Here's the Storm Tracker forecast. After a couple rainy and chilly days to wrap up the weekend and start the week, we are returning to seasonal temperatures across the Northland on Tuesdays. Highs climb up into the 60s, that's tomorrow, with the sun peeking through a few clouds for most of the region. As we go into the evening, we will see scattered showers already Wednesday evening. We're moving through much of the region, but moving out, evidently showers are tonight, moving out by Wednesday morning. So, it's been fun to look at the snow depth, which is now zero. So far, since July 1, we have had 38.7 inches of snow. Our average is closer to 90 inches, and then I just love reading that last year we had 140 inches of snow. Thank goodness that won't be happening this year. This year it's actually, hopefully, we won't get any more snow. Now, Nancy, have you found the Superior Telegram?
I've got it.
Okay, I'm going to try to find it, too.
Okay. I'm going to start with Duluth's best bread is to open a store in Superior.
All righty.
All right, come on now. There it is. And accompanied by a picture by Maria Lockwood Duluth's best bread co-owner Robert Lilligard on the left and manager Casey Brown serve customers at a pop-up location in Superior, 1418 Tower Avenue on March 20th. After this successful pop-up, the Lilligards are planning to open a new bakery cafe in the location.
Ooh.
So, yep, there you can see, 20 loaves of bread and packaging. In the foreground, and then you can see those shelves with drawers on them in the background with what looks like more sweets and mm-hmm. other kinds of goodies, and mm-hmm. then his wife in the background, and three customers, one making a purchase and the other two waiting. Anyway, this is by Shelley Nelson of the Superior Telegram. Duluth's Best Bread is opening a location in Superior. After a successful pop-up run in March, owners Robert and Michelle Lilligard.
Michael. It's Robert and Michael.
Okay.
Brothers.
Okay.
Lilligard.
Okay. Oh, it's the old manager, Casey Brown, in the background. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't know that. Robert and Michael Lilligard decided to make the site a permanent location at 1418 Tower Avenue. Quote, "The response was really great," said Robert Lilligard, "and the community looks really interested. With Superior coming out in a huge way," quote, in quotes, he said it made the decision to open a location in Superior really clear. But don't expect the name to change. Quote, "People ask us, will you be Superior's best bread?" Robert said. "We're going to be like Seattle's best or Milwaukee's best. The name stays."
Yeah.
End quote. Michael Lilligard said keeping the name actually makes things easier. Quote, "It's a more defensible claim," he said. "We don't have to prove we're the best bread in Superior, too. Just in Duluth." End quote. Duluth's Best Bread will open May 28th and operate 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesdays through Sundays at 1418 Tower Avenue. I'll repeat that. It's going to open May 28th and operate 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesdays through Sundays at 1418 Tower Avenue. The family-owned French-German bakery opened its first store in 2015 in Lincoln Park, and its second store in 2022 in downtown Duluth. Like the downtown Duluth store, the store in Superior will be a bakery cafe where people can sip an Italian-style espresso and eat a croissant or pick up fresh baguettes for the day, Lilligard said. The bakery will serve its entire product line of French and German baked goods. But folks won't have to wait until May 28th to get Duluth's Best Bread in Superior. Mama T's, Smoke and Eats, Bucktails, and Aces on 29th carry the company's German pretzels. And 2540 Coffee carries its cookies. The company also delivers taste tester boxes to homes in Superior on the second Thursday of each month. Sign up online at duluthsbestbread.com.
So wonderful to hear about a successful business that was born in Duluth.
Yes.
Oh. Okay. The front page of the Superior Telegram is dominated by pictures of children singing in a choir. The collective title for these pictures is Sing in Spring. I'll read you the story first, and then I will describe the pictures to you. Sixth graders at Superior Middle School hold a spring concert. Music filled the cafetorium at Superior Middle School on Tuesday, April 23, as the sixth grade choir students performed their spring choir concert. After a performance from the Spartan Stars, the sixth graders took the stage and performed four songs for the crowd, directed by Riley Newton. The largest picture at the top of the page shows middle school choir director Riley Newton, dressed in black, directing the sixth grade choir as they sing Fly Away Home during the spring concert at SMS on April 23. And sure enough, there are four rows of gorgeous children dressed in, they're all actually in very casual pants, blue jeans, shorts. Some of those blue jeans, of course, are torn at the knees. All of the children are wearing a black T-shirt. It's probably from Superior Middle School. I can't really see. Oh, there it is on the bottom. I can see that. It is the Superior Spartan Choir T-shirt. They are singing very calmly, hands to their sides. and very engaged in their performance. In the foreground, we have the piano player, the accompanist, playing for the choir. Another picture, oh my gosh, shows the size. Actually, it's a better picture showing the size of these sixth grade students as they perform Shine Like Stars. There have to be almost 100 children in this choir, showing a great level of participation. So again, it's the students in the darkened theater with their conductor in front of them singing a song. And the next picture is a close-up, closer-up view of some of the students as they perform Be Like the Bird. So we can see their engaged, young, beautiful faces in their Superior Spartan T-shirts and their blue jeans singing for their audience. Okay, what is the next article that you have there?
Okay, we have UWS breaks ground for Superior Choice Credit Union Stadium. And this is it just says by Superior Telegram. Mm-hmm. Construction has begun on the Superior Choice Credit Union Stadium on the University of Wisconsin Superior campus. Work at the site began April 15th, according to the college, while a formal groundbreaking for the $7.1 million project took place Thursday, April 25th. Initial work will concentrate on the parking areas and green space near Crownheart Hall, focusing primarily on site preparation and utility installations. The facility is expected to be ready for competition in September. Superior Choice Credit Union Stadium will serve as the home for the UWS men's and women's soccer teams, as well as the men's and women's outdoor track and field teams. The facility will feature a regulation turf playing surface surrounded by a nine-lane track along with a grandstand and press facilities. Currently, UWS is undergoing a fundraising campaign for additional stadium amenities. The campaign includes an initiative to name the track in honor of UWS alumnus and local running legend Dan Conway, as well as the creation of a facility donor wall. Visit Yellow Jacket Athletics Giving or contact Yellow Jacket Athletics at 715-395-4619 for more information.
Okay.
And we got two photographs. One is I zoom at the site. I can see there's a big sign that says Stadium Superior Choice Credit Union opening fall 2024. Learn more and support the project. And so a big picture of what this is intended to look like, with a big parking lot in front, some existing buildings off to the right, and a big soccer field with a nice track around it in the background. Mm-hmm. And it looks like it's right at the site, because in the distance I can see the soccer goal, that existing soccer goal on there. Mm-hmm. Whoops, I just missed that. I was going to look at I think there's one more picture with this.
I can't find it.
Oh, no, it is just the one picture.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. That's why it went away.
Okay. Right. Okay, thank you, Nancy. We're going to turn to page 2 of the Superior Telegram. I see a story entitled Chamber Honors Outstanding Superior and Douglas County Businesses, Individuals at Event. Again, this comes to us from the Superior Telegram. Two area businesses and two business professionals were honored at the 70th Chamber Annual Meeting and Business Awards on Thursday, April 25, in the Yellow Jacket Union on the University of Wisconsin Superior campus. The Chamber Annual Meeting and Business Awards is hosted each year by the Superior Douglas County Area Chamber of Commerce to bring the business community together to celebrate the past year of hard work, look forward to the year ahead, and honor outstanding businesses and individuals in the community. This year's event included a keynote address and operational update delivered by Enbridge. A crowd of more than 220 community members, business leaders, and elected officials gathered to honor the business community and the following award winners. Weeping Willow Heartfelt Gifts won the New Business of the Year. Globe News / Vinyl Cave was named Outstanding Business of the Year. Dr. William Zimmer from Imperium Chiropractic won the Outstanding Young Professional Award. And Aaron Grabinger, Grabinger, from Head of the Lakes United Way, was winner of the Chamber Ambassador of the Year Award. Visit the Superior Douglas Area County Chamber of Commerce website, superiorchamber.org, or Superior Chamber of Commerce Facebook page for more information on the award categories. So this article indeed has like a million it has six pictures. So the first picture shows Taylor Peterson standing to the left, and the CEO of, he is the president and CEO of the Superior Douglas County Area Chamber of Commerce, as he presents the Outstanding Young Professional Award to Dr. William Zimmer from Imperium Chiropractic. There are two men in this picture. They're standing in front of a screen where the program was obviously projected, and it is the chamber's logo saying thank you. And on left, Taylor Peterson, who is the president, is pictured as a person wearing a suit and tie. He looks very professional. He has on one of those short mustache beards that are so popular with certain men these days. And he is standing next to a much taller young man, who is Dr. William Zimmer, who has won the Outstanding Young Professional of the Year. He, too, has on a suit jacket and pants, but his shirt is buttoned. It has no tie. And he has one of those haircuts that's very short on the sides and longer on the top, smiling, holding his award. The next picture shows five young professionals with Taylor Peterson, who is the president. He's presenting the Outstanding Business of the Year Award to Danny Haskins, John Fritchie, Randy Ross, and Anna Haskins of Globe News Vinyl Cave during that meeting. So these people are dressed in a little bit more casual way. The person next to Taylor Peterson is, again, a young man with one of those short beard mustache combos. He's got on a casual shirt. He's a little bit taller than Taylor Peterson, but it looks like most people are. In front of him is another young man who has that short side cut with longer hair on top. He has on a sport coat and white shirt. He's holding the award. The third person, who is probably Randy Ross, is a young person with much longer hair below the ears. He's wearing glasses. He has a nice smile, wearing a casual shirt and pants, and he's got the Outstanding Business of the Year award also in front of him. And standing next to him, we have Anna Haskins, also holding a framed certificate. This person has a wavy, longish blondish hair. She's very, very happy in the picture. She has on a lovely spring dress and casual shoes. Then in the next picture, we have, again, Mr. Taylor Peterson standing next to the Chamber Ambassador of the Year, Aaron Grabinger, of the head of the Lakes United Way. So it's just the two of them in the picture. He has the paper award. She is carrying her award that has a wooden base, a glass top. She has longish, curly brown hair, very, very youngish, happy, beautiful face, wearing a dress and a little short shrug sweater. And the final picture shows yet more award winners. They are co-owner Colleen Lampton and other members of the Weeping Willow team. So these are the people from the gift shop who won the new Business of the Year award. There are four of them standing next to Taylor Peterson. One of them is wearing a longish dress, and she is holding her award with the wooden base and the glass top. And the others have various renditions of the paper awards that the team received. A very happy group. So that is the end of this story. Nancy, what do you have?
Well, right next to that, we have Douglas County Past.
Ah, yes.
This is from April 26th of 1939. It says, Solon Springs Postmaster marks 50 years, Superior Boy Bandits jailed.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, it starts out, though, with... three students winners in city poster contest.
April 26, 1939.
Winners in three divisions of the American Dental Association's annual poster contest in Superior were announced Wednesday by a panel of three judges. First place awards went to Joyce Anderson Erickson School fifth grader, in Class 2 to Clarence Jones, North Junior High 7th grader, in Class 3, and Dorothy Frederick, Central High School Junior in Class 4. The first three winners in each division will compete in the state contest at Madison, and the state winners will compete in the national event. In 1938, Superior took 5 out of 12 awards at the state competition. There were 3 more champions in marble tourneys picked. 3 more school championships were decided in the 4th annual Evening Telegram's Marbles Championship when the St. Adalbert's, St. Francis, and Central High tournaments were completed. William Runke, 1938 City and Northern Wisconsin champion, won the Central High event by defeating Siegfried Groven, 1936 City champion, and 1937 Northern Wisconsin champion in the finals. Two brothers fought it out for the St. Francis School Championship with Florin McConnell, defeating his brother Richard in the final match. At the St. Adalbert's parochial school, Eddie Kosick bested Clarence Melanowski in the championship match. The 12 preliminary tournaments drew an entry of 293 players. 9 more tournaments scheduled for the St. Stanislaus, St. Louis, St. Patrick's, St. Margaret's, Itasca, McCaskill, Cathedral, Cooper, and Bryant schools will be completed Wednesday afternoon. The Grand City Championship will be held at the Blaine Playground Saturday, April 29th, starting at 9:30 a.m. Marbles tournaments. And April 28th, 1924, local quartet in cyclonic motor journey from coast, a cyclonic transcontinental drive from Los Angeles to Superior was completed last Friday afternoon by four Superior young men in what is believed to be one of the fastest trips ever made over the route they took. The men, Lewis Peters, who owned the car in which they made the drive, Al Stederstrom, Thorwald Oye, and Donald White, all of Superior, made the trip in actual running time of less than 130 hours, covering, in that time, 2,700 miles. The start was made on Thursday morning, April 17th, from the city of Los Angeles, and after 8 days, the quartet brought up at Superior. Two stops of 1 day each were made at Mason City, Iowa, and Minneapolis, where minor repairs were made to the machine. The average time running was almost 21 miles to the hour, which is extraordinarily fast for such a trip. Prompt action of YMCA night clerk prevents conflagration. Prompt action by Arthur LeBlanc, night clerk, saved one man from burns and checked what might have been a serious fire when the bedding in a dormitory room at the YMCA became ignited from a cigarette late Sunday night, according to C.A. Manning, General Secretary. LeBlanc, smelling smoke while working on the first floor, ran to the second floor and saw the smoke slowly drifting from a narrow space at the threshold. Entering the room, he awakened Theodore Thompson, who had fallen asleep while smoking. He smothered the smoldering remnants of a burned blanket. Returning to the YMCA at midnight after lunch, he again was attracted by the smell of smoke. The occupant had been transferred elsewhere, but LeBlanc, upon entering the damaged room, found the mattress and pad on the floor in flames. Once again, he extinguished them after raising the window. And April 29th, 1924, jail for 9 boy bandits. Sentences ranging from 1 to 2.5 years confinement in state penal institutes were pronounced by Judge Archibald McKay of Superior Court this morning over 9 of the 12 youthful confessed bandits arrested by Superior Police recently following depredations in all parts of the city. Characterizing the offense is as very grave, Lon Stigney, age 16, and in quotes, boy gunman, was given a term of 2.5 years in the state prison at Waupun by the judge. Stigney had confessed to holding up Sam Wah, a Chinese laundryman, at the point of a gun in his shop while Stigney's companions rifled the cash register. Jeez, 5 members of what police termed the, quote, 21st Street Gang were given terms of 19 months each in the state reformatory at Green Bay. Harold Tracy, age 17, Clarence Real, age 19, Andrew Brown, age 20, Henry Hammer, age 19, and Burton Bingham, age 18, are the culprits. These boys, together with Stigney, alleged leader of the gang, confessed to breaking and robbing 11 stores located in various parts of the city, among them the May Furniture Company, W. Samuelson Barbershop, Alec Nelson Barbershop, Lewis Larson Shoe Repair Shop, Sam Lee Confectionery Store, G. Darwin Store, East 5th Street Market Basket Store, Palace Market, Central Park Grocery Store, and Sam Wah Laundry. Ray Lambs, age 17, Arthur Kurtz, age 17, and Austin Freeney, age 18, residents of Eloise, who confessed to breaking in and robbing the H. Caner, a confectionery store, were sentenced to terms of 1 year each in the Green Bay Institution. Eddie Olson, age 15, member of the 21st Street Gang, and John Kubelek, age 17, and Henry Fleming, age 17, were remanded to the custody of Sheriff William H. Hargreen. until this afternoon when their cases will be disposed of by the court. Boy, that's a serious round of death.
Next, we'll move on to the sports page. We have local sports for Tuesday for Superior. There are two articles. The first is a prep report. The second is a Yellow Jackets report. So after that, then we will be completing our reading of the papers for today. So the first prep report article is Superior Baseball Outlasts Chippewa Falls for the Split. Superior Baseball worked overtime to secure a victory on Friday night, outlasting Chippewa Falls 9-8 to win in the ninth inning of Game 2 of the doubleheader at NBC Spartan Sports Complex. Tanner Leno's RBI single with one out in the ninth inning scored Evan Blumfeld and won the game for the Spartans. Sam Hubbard had a pair of hits and four RBIs for Superior, which scored five times in the first inning before allowing Chi High to get back into it. Once the visitors tied it at five in the fifth inning, Superior scored three more runs, only for Chippewa Falls to tie it a second time and send it to extras. The pitching win went to Jace Rue, who allowed three runs, one earned, in four innings of relief. Game one was all Chippewa Falls as Superior struggled mightily with control in a 14-3 loss. Six players had one hit apiece, with Cam Laporte recording a two-run double. Andrew Melgeorge took the loss. Hayward 8-7, Northwestern 3-6. The Tigers dropped a pair of home games on Friday in Iron River. In the first contest, Ethan Harms had three hits, half of his team's total, all of them singles. Austin Lottie took the loss, allowing seven earned runs on six hits in five innings. Lottie had a pair of hits in Game 2, including an RBI single, with two out in the seventh inning that made it a one-runner game. But after the runners moved up a base on an error, the Hurricanes used a fielder's choice to get out of the bases-loaded jam. Tyler Nelson took the loss for Northwestern, allowing four runs, one earned, and eight hits in five innings. Northwood Solon Springs 11, Bruce 1. Jared Schultz was in control on Thursday, April 25, allowing one run on three hits in a six-inning complete game. He struck out 11 and walked none. In contrast, the Green Eagles drew 10 free passes and six more were hit by pitches, as NSS had only three hits, two of them by Abe Alberg, who doubled and homered. I have lost my way. We are looking at softball. It's about Chippewa. There it is. Chippewa Falls, 8-10. Superior 6-3. Superior dropped a pair of pivotal games on the road against Chippewa Falls on Friday afternoon in the race for WIAA Regional Softball Tournament seeding, 8-6 and 10-3. Superior struck first in the opening inning as Melania Lustari and Gabby Sari both cranked RBI doubles that gave Superior a 2-0 lead. Chippewa responded with a three-run bottom of the first frame that gave the Cardinals a 3-2 advantage. The Spartans scored four runs in the second inning and grabbed a 6-3 lead, but Chippewa Falls scored five runs in the ensuing three frames. Ari Robillard pitched all six innings and gave up 8 earned runs on 9 hits and 4 walks while she struck out 2 in the loss. The latter half of the doubleheader was more of the same as Chippewa Falls rode a 5-run first inning to a blowout win against the Spartans. The singles by the Cardinals paved the way for a 3-run bomb that opened the game up early. 3 straight singles and a double in the gap scored 2 more runs, giving Chippewa Falls a 5-0 advantage. Superior scored 1 run in each of the 4th, 5th, and 6th innings before Chippewa Falls added 5 more runs in the top of the 7th inning to put away the game and sweep the Spartans in the series. The Robillard gave up 5 earned runs off of 7 hits in just 1 inning of action in the 2nd game. Emma Lampton surrendered 5 earned runs on 9 hits in 6 innings of work. Superior 13, Cloquet 3. Melania Lustari had a 3-run double and an RBI triple in her 3-hit game as the Spartans rolled at NBC Spartan Sports Complex. Superior hung a 5 on the scoreboard in the 3rd and 4th innings to take command of the game, finishing with 16 hits. Elena DeGraff also had 3 hits, while 4 other players had 2. And next in this is track and field, Rice Lake Invitational. A 1-2 finish from Taylor McKeeken and Elena Almonte was the highlight of Superior's day at the Rice Lake Invitational on Thursday, April 25. McMeekin broke the tape in the 800-meter run in 2 minutes, 28.74 seconds, with her teammate about 2.5 seconds behind. Both runners, who are sophomores, combined with teammates Veronica Acuraro and Kylie Peterson for second in the 4-800 relay. In the field events, Superior's Maggie Stanberg tied for fourth in pole vault, clearing 8 feet. On the boys' side, the top Superior finish came from Braylon Lemieux, who was third in discus with a heave of 120-1. The Superior girls finished 8th and the boys 9th. And finally, in boys' tennis, Cloquet Esco Carlton 6, Superior 1. The Lumberjacks had a strong performance on their home courts against the Spartans, collecting all 6 of their points in straight sets. Number 1 singles, Ethan Levan was 6-0, 6-1 winner over Vinnie Tyson, while number 1 doubles, Ethan Doty and Max Sundquist of CEC, won 6-1, 6-1 over Aaron Moen and Paolo Pagnucci. Superior claimed its lone point at number 4 singles, where Jack Mueller ousted CEC's Tommy Radosovic 3-6, 6-2, and 7-5. Huh. So what's happening with the Yellow Jackets?
Yellow Jackets, the staff reports, back-to-back softball and baseball. Back-to-back homers from Ellie McCall and Indigo Fish tied, then gave Wisconsin Superior the lead in the first game of an Upper Midwest Athletic Conference softball doubleheader against Northwestern on Saturday, April 27th at NBC Spartan Sports Complex in Superior. UWS held on to win game 1, 6-5, but suffered a 9-1 defeat in game 2. Fish, a Superior Spartans alum and freshman, had 2 homers in the game, both solo shots to left field. The first came in the second inning, while the second gave UWS its first lead of the game. Fish, McCall, and Carly Stuckmayer all had 2 hits, with Stuckmayer tying the game for the first time on a 2-run single in the 4th inning. Emma Pillian earned the win in relief, while Bella Garley pitched two scoreless innings for a save. In the second game, Northwestern scored six runs in the first inning and forced a UWS pitching change, while Eagles pitching held the Yellow Jackets to four singles and one unearned run for the game. Garley took the loss. UWS will host local rival St. Scholastica for a doubleheader on Wednesday in Superior before concluding conference play on Friday and Saturday in Mankato at Bethany Lutheran. And now in baseball, Jackets dropped two at Northwestern. After dropping the first game of their series, Northwestern countered and passed Wisconsin Superior in the Upper Midwest Athletic Conference baseball standings with a doubleheader sweep, 11-2 and 4-3 on Saturday, April 27th in St. Paul. In Game 2, UWS attempted a comeback from 4-1, down entering the ninth inning. With two doubles and a single, the Yellow Jackets generated two runs and had the tying run in scoring position, but back-to-back groundouts ended the threat. Johnny Rhodes, Tanner Voigt, and Nikki Fredrickson had two hits apiece for UWS. Aiden Pfeiffer allowed four runs on five hits in seven innings to take the loss, with the Eagles getting home runs in the first and seventh innings to get and build their lead. The opener got away from UWS early, as Northwestern scored four times in the second inning and twice in the third for an early 6-0 lead. Zach Romans suffered his first loss of the season, with four of the six runs on eight hits he allowed in 2.5 innings being unearned. UWS had six hits, with its only hits coming from the same play, a sixth-inning throwing error. The top four teams in the UMAC are separated by 1.5 games in the standings and are playing each other for the last three games of the regular season starting on Friday. UWS will play a non-conference game at Scholastica on Monday, April 29th. Then host Bethany Lutheran on Friday, May 3rd in Superior. Wisconsin Superior made the first move in a crowded stretch drive in the Upper Midwest Athletic Conference, taking the league's lead with a 9-5 win at Northwestern on Thursday, April 25th. The Yellow Jackets fell behind 5-4 in the fourth inning, but scored the game's last five runs, pulling ahead on an RBI double from Trey Sebrant in the fifth. Peyton Stein hit a solo shot to make it 7-5 in the seventh inning, and the visitors tacked on two more runs in the ninth. Nick Fredrickson and Noah D'Agostino led the attack with three hit games, and the next five men in the UWS lineup had two hits apiece. On the mound, Ethan Cody tossed five innings of scoreless relief for a win, allowing only three hits and striking out two.
Excellent. All right. Nancy, thank you so much. We are Tracy Goman and Nancy Etzen. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Thank you.